take Roland out in some other way before he has the chance to use it. The question is this. Is Connor willing to enter a battle that must end with one of them dead? Connor might be a lot of things, but he's no killer. So he holds his temper and plays it cool. This is new territory for him. The fighter in him screams foul, but another side of him, a side that's growing steadily stronger, enjoys this exercise of silent power. And it is power. Because Roland now behaves exactly the way he and Risa want him to. Connor sees Roland offer his dessert to Risa that night as an apology. She doesn't accept it, of course, but it doesn't change the fact that he offered it. It's as if Roland thinks his attack on her could be wiped away by feigning remorse. Not because he's actually sorry for what he did, but because it serves Roland's needs to treat her well now. He has no idea that Risa and Connor have him on an invisible leash. Connor knows it will only be a matter of time, however, until he chews his way through it.
Part 4. Destinations. The following is a response from eBay with regard to a seller's attempt to auction his soul online in 2001. Thank you for taking the time to write eBay with your concerns. I'm happy to help you further. If the soul does not exist, eBay could not allow the auctioning of the soul because there would be nothing to sell. However, if the soul does exist, then in accordance with eBay's policy on human parts and remains, we would not allow the auctioning of human souls. The soul would be considered human remains, and although it is not specifically stated on the policy page, human souls are still not allowed to be listed on eBay. Your auction was removed appropriately and will not be reinstated. Please do not relist this item with us in the future. You may review our policy at the following link, http://pages.ebay.com/help/policies/remains.html. It is my pleasure to assist you. Thank you for choosing eBay. 26. Pawnbroker. The man inherited the pawn shop from his brother, who had died of a heart attack. He wouldn't have kept the place, but he inherited it while he was unemployed. He figured he could keep it and run it until he could find a better job. That was 20 years ago. Now he knows it's a life sentence. A boy comes into his shop one evening before closing. Not his usual type of customer. Most folks come into a pawn shop down on their luck, ready to trade in everything they own, from TVs to family heirlooms, in exchange for a little quick cash. Some do it for drugs. Others have more legitimate reasons. Either way, the pawnbroker's success is based on the misery of others. It doesn't bother him anymore. He's grown used to it. This boy is different, though. Sure, there are kids who come in, hoping to get a deal on items that were never claimed. But there's something about this kid that's markedly off. He looks more clean-cut than the kids that usually turn up in his store. And the way he moves, even the way he holds himself, is refined and graceful, deliberate and delicate. Like he's lived his life as a prince and is now pretending to be the pauper. He wears a puffy white coat, but it's a bit dirty. Maybe he's a pauper after all. The TV on the counter plays a football game, but the pawnbroker isn't watching the game anymore. His eyes are on it, but his mind is keeping track of the kid as he meanders through the shop, looking at things, like he might want to buy something. After a few minutes, the kid approaches the counter.
"What can I do for you?"
the pawnbroker asks, genuinely curious.
"This is a pawn shop, isn't it? Doesn't it say so on the door? So that means you trade things for money, right?"
The pawnbroker sighs. The kid's just ordinary after all, just a little more naive than the other kids who show up here trying to hawk their baseball card collections or whatever. Usually they want money for cigarettes or alcohol or something else they don't want their parents to know about. This kid doesn't look like the type for that, though.
"We loan money and take objects of value as collateral," he tells the kid. "And we don't do business with minors. You want to buy something, fine, but you can't pawn anything here, so take your baseball cards somewhere else."
"Who said I have baseball cards?" Then the kid reaches into his pocket and pulls out a bracelet, all diamonds and gold.
The pawnbroker's eyes all but pop out of his skull as the kid dangles it from his fingers. Then the pawnbroker laughs.
What'd you do? Steal that from your mommy, kid?
The kid's expression stays diamond hard.
How much will you give me for it?
How about a nice boot out the door? Still, the kid shows no sign of fear or disappointment. He just lays the bracelet on the worn wooden counter with that same princely grace.
Why don't you just put that thing away and go home?
I'm an unwind.
What?
You heard me.
This throws the pawnbroker for a loop for a whole lot of reasons. First of all, runaway unwinds who show up at his shop never admit it. Secondly, they always appear desperate and angry, and the stuff they have to sell is shoddy at best. They're never this calm, and they never look this angelic.
You're an unwind?
The boy nods. The bracelet is stolen, but not from anywhere around here. Unwinds also never admit that their items are stolen. Those other kids always come up with the most elaborate stories as to who they are and why they're selling. The pawnbroker will usually listen to their stories for their entertainment value. If it's a good story, he'll just throw the kid out. If it's a lousy story, he'll call the police and have them picked up. This kid, however, doesn't have a story. He comes only with the truth. The pawnbroker doesn't quite know how to deal with the truth.
So, says the kid, are you interested?
The pawnbroker just shrugs.
Who you are is your business, and like I said, I don't deal with minors.
Maybe you'll make an exception.
The pawnbroker considers the kid, considers the bracelet, then looks at the door to make sure no one else is coming in.
I'm listening. Here's what I want. $500 cash. Now, then I leave like we never met, and you can keep the bracelet.
The pawnbroker puts on his well-practiced poker face.
Are you kidding me? This piece of junk? Gold plate, zircons instead of diamonds, poor workmanship. Give you $100, not a penny more.
The kid never breaks eye contact. You're lying.
Of course the pawnbroker is lying, but he resents the accusation.
How about if I turn you into the juvie cops right now?
The kid reaches down and takes the bracelet from the table.
You could, he says, but then you won't get this. The police will.
The pawnbroker strokes his beard. Maybe this kid isn't as naive as he looks.
If it were a piece of junk, the kid says, you wouldn't have offered me $100. I'll bet you wouldn't have offered me anything.
He looks at the bracelet dangling from his fingers.
I really don't know what something like this is worth, but I'll bet it's worth thousands. All I'm asking is $500,
which means, whatever it's worth, you're getting a great deal. The pawnbroker's poker face is gone. He can't stop staring at the bracelet. It's all he can do not to drool over it. He knows what it's really worth, or at least he can guess. He knows where he can fence it himself for 5 times what the kid is asking. That would be a nice bit of change, enough to take his wife on that long vacation she's always wanted.
$250. That's my final offer.
$500. You have 3 seconds and then I leave. 1, 2,
deal.
The pawnbroker sighs as if he's been beaten.
You drive a hard bargain, kid.
That's the way these things are played. Make the kid think that he won, when all the while he's the one who's truly being robbed. The pawnbroker reaches for the bracelet, but the kid holds it out of reach.
First the money.
Safe's in the back room. I'll be back in a second.
I'll come with you.
The pawnbroker doesn't argue. It's understandable that the kid doesn't trust him. If he trusted people, he'd have been unwound by now. In the back room, the pawnbroker positions himself with the kid behind him so the kid can't see the combination of the safe. He pulls open the door, and the second he does, he feels something hard and heavy connecting with his head. His thoughts are instantly scrambled. He loses consciousness before he hits the ground. The pawnbroker comes to sometime later, with a headache and a faint memory that something had gone wrong. It takes a few seconds for him to pull himself together and realize exactly what happened. That little monster conned him. He got him to open the safe, and the moment he did, he knocked him out and cleaned out the safe. Sure enough, the safe is open wide. But it's not entirely empty. Inside is the bracelet, its gold and diamonds looking even brighter against the ugly gray steel of the empty safe. How much money had been in the safe? 1,500, tops.
This bracelet is worth at least three times that. Still a deal, and the kid knew it. The pawnbroker rubs the painful knot on his head, furious at the kid for what he did, and yet admiring him for the strangely honorable nature of the crime. If he himself had been this clever, this honorable, and had found this kind of nerve when he was a kid, perhaps he'd be more than just a pawnbroker.
27. Connor.
The morning after the bathroom incident, they are rousted awake by the fatigues before dawn.
Everybody up! Now! Move it! Move it!
They're loud, they're on edge, and the first thing Connor notices is that the safeties on their weapons are off. Still bleary from sleep, he rises and looks for Risa. He sees her already being herded by two fatigues toward a huge double door that has always been padlocked. Now the padlock is off.
Leave your things! Go! Move it! Move it!
To his right, a cranky kid pushes a fatigue for tearing away his blanket. The fatigue hits him on the shoulder with the butt of his rifle. Not enough to seriously wound him, but enough to make it clear to the kid, and everyone else, that they mean business. The kid goes down on his knees, gripping his shoulder and cursing, and the fatigue goes about the business of hurting the others. Even in his pain, the kid looks ready for a fight. As Connor passes him, Connor grabs him by the arm and helps him up.
Take it easy, Connor says. Don't make it worse.
The kid pulls out of Connor's grip.
Get off me! I don't need your stinking help.
The kid storms away. Connor shakes his head. Was he ever that belligerent? Up ahead, the huge double doors are slid open to reveal another room of the warehouse that the Unwinds have never seen. This one is filled with crates. Old airline packing crates, designed both in shape and durability, to transport goods by air freight. Connor immediately realizes what they're for, and why he and the others have been warehoused so close to an airport. Wherever they're going as air cargo.
Girls to the left, boys to the right, move it, move it!
There's grumbling, but no direct defiance. Connor wonders how many kids get what's going on.
Four to a crate, boys with boys, girls with girls, move it, move it!
Now everyone begins to scramble around, trying to team up with their preferred travel companions. But the fatigues have neither patience nor time for it. They randomly create groups of four and push them toward the crates. That's when Connor notices how dangerously close he is to Roland, and it's no accident. Roland moved close to him on purpose. Connor can just imagine it. Pitch black and close quarters. If he's in a crate with Roland, then he'll be dead before takeoff. Connor tries to move away, but a fatigue grabs Roland, Connor, and two of Roland's known collaborators.
You four! That crate over there!
Connor tries not to let his panic show. He doesn't want Roland to see. He should have prepared his own weapon, like the one Roland certainly has concealed on him now. He should have prepared for the inevitability of a life-or-death confrontation, but he hadn't, and now his options are limited. No time for thinking this through. So he lets impulse take over and gives in to his fighting instincts. He turns to one of Roland's henchmen and punches him in the face hard enough to draw blood, maybe even break his nose. The force of the punch spins the kid around, but before he can come back for a counter-assault, a fatigue grabs Connor and smashes him back against the concrete wall. The fatigue doesn't know it, but this is exactly what Connor wanted.
You picked the wrong day to do that, kid!
Says the fatigue, holding him against the wall with his rifle.
What are you gonna do, kill me? I thought you were trying to save us.
That gives the fatigue a moment's pause.
Hey!
Yells another fatigue.
Forget him! We gotta load them up!
Then he grabs another kid to complete the foursome with Roland and his henchmen, sending them toward a crate. They don't even care about the one kid's bleeding nose. The fatigue holding Connor against the wall sneers at him.
The sooner you're in a box, the sooner you're somebody else's problem.
Nice socks, says Connor. They put Connor in a 4x8 crate that already has three kids waiting to complete their quartet. The crate is sealed even before he can see who's inside with him, but as long as it's not Roland, it will do.
We're all gonna die in here, says a nasal voice, followed by a wet sniff that doesn't sound like it clears much of anything.
Connor knows this kid by his mucus. He's not sure of his name. Everyone just calls him the mouth breather, since his nose is perpetually stuffed. Emby, for short.
He's the one always obsessively reading his comic book, but he can't quite do that in here.
Don't talk like that, says Connor. If the fatigues wanted to kill us, they would have done it a long time ago.
The mouth breather has foul breath that's filling up the whole crate.
Maybe they got fouled out. Maybe the juvie cops are on their way, and the only way to save themselves is to destroy the evidence.
Connor has little patience for whiners. It reminds him too much of his younger brother, the one his parents chose to keep.
Shut up, Emby, or I swear I'm going to take off my sock, shove it in your stinky mouth, and you'll finally have to figure out a way to breathe through your nose.
Let me know if you need an extra sock, says a voice just across from him.
Hi, Connor. It's Hayden.
Hey, Hayden. Connor reaches out and finds Hayden's shoe, squeezing it, the closest thing to a greeting in the claustrophobic darkness.
So, who's lucky number four?
No answer.
Sounds like we must be traveling with a mime.
Another long pause, then Connor hears a deep, accented voice.
Diego.
Diego doesn't talk much, says Hayden.
I figured.
They wait in silence, punctuated by the mouth breather's snorts.
I gotta go to the bathroom,
Emby mumbles.
You should have thought of that before you left, says Hayden, putting on his best mother voice.
How many times do we have to tell you? Always use the potty before climbing into a shipping crate.
There's some sort of mechanical activity outside. Then they feel the crate moving.
I don't like this,
whines Emby.
We're being moved, says Hayden.
By forklift, probably, says Connor. The fatigues are probably long gone by now.
What was it that one fatigue had said?
Once you're in a box, you're somebody else's problem. Whoever's been hired to ship them probably has no clue what's in the crates. Soon they'll be on board some aircraft, headed to an undisclosed destination. The thought of it makes him think about the rest of his family and their trip to the Bahamas, the one they'd planned to take once Connor was unwound. He wonders if they went. Would they still take their vacation even after Connor had kicked AWOL? Sure they would. They were planning to take it once he got unwound, so why would his escape stop them?
Hey, wouldn't it be funny if they were being shipped to the Bahamas, too?
We're gonna suffocate. I know it,
announces the mouth breather.
Will you shut up? Says Connor.
I'm sure there's more than enough air in here for us.
How do you know? I can barely breathe already, and I got asthma, too. I could have an asthma attack in here and die.
Good, says Connor. One less person breathing the air. That shuts MB up, but Connor feels bad having said it.
No one's going to die, he says. Just relax.
And then Hayden says, at least dying's better than being unwound.
Or is it?
Let's take a poll. Would you rather die or be unwound?
Don't ask things like that, snaps Connor. I don't want to think about either.
Somewhere outside of their little crated universe, Connor hears a metal hatch closing and can feel the vibration in his feet as they begin to taxi.
Connor waits.
Engines power up. He can feel the vibration in his feet. He's pushed back against the wall as they accelerate. Hayden tumbles into him and he shifts over, giving Hayden room to get comfortable again.
What's happening? What's happening?
Cries Emby.
Nothing. We're just taking off.
What? We're on a plane?
Connor rolls his eyes, but the gesture is lost in the darkness. The box is like a coffin. The box is like a womb. Normal measures of time don't seem to apply, and the unpredictable turbulence of flight fills the dark space with an ever-present tension. Once they're airborne, the four kids don't speak for a very long time. Half an hour maybe, it's hard to tell. Everyone's mind is trapped in the holding pattern of their own uneasy thoughts. The plane hits some rough air. Everything around them rattles. Connor wonders if there are kids in crates above them, below them, and on every side. He can't hear their voices if they are. From where he sits, it feels like the four of them are the only ones in the universe. Emby silently relieves himself. Connor knows because he can smell it. Everyone can, but no one says anything. It could just as easily have been any one of them, and depending on how long the trip is, it still could be. Finally, after what feels like forever, the quietest of them all speaks.
Unwound, Diego says. I'd rather be unwound. Even though it's been a long time since Hayden posed the question, Connor knows immediately what it refers to. Would you rather die or be unwound? It's like the question has hung in the cramped darkness all this time, waiting to be answered. Not be, says Emby. Because if you die, at least you go to heaven.
Heaven?